Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio, and the big news is that MP.com is back up and running. Oh, man.
Holy it's like, crap. That was scary.
Yeah. It was like our home was taken away. I don't know how you felt, Owen, but, you know, it's like kind of like, I don't know, man. I would go there every day, and it was like for the since
it
like
was
2008.
Yeah, I know, and then you were lost. You were actually had to do work at work, I know. But the problem, you see now, like, I had been kind of absent from the forum since I started working at the laboratory because, you know, you use no computers, you bust your ass all day, come home, and I would just forget. Now that I'm in front of a computer all day, it's like, let's check on the forums. So, of course, you don't appreciate something until it's taken away from you, so...
Yeah.
All of a sudden, MP is gone. I'm like, what am I going to do? Go Facebook all day? And it was very upsetting. And thank God it's back, even though it's not quite back. They have to do a little bit more tweaking. But, you know, a big thanks to Sean, who tirelessly brought back our home. So
yeah. So, yeah, it looks a bit different. I know they updated the software to the latest version of vBulletin, and he said the design skins are completely different. So I guess when they're done doing the cosmetic part of it, it's probably going to have a different look.
I imagine they'll retweak things to get everything back to – get everything that we need or want back on there. So,
yeah, I mean, you know. It's I saw some cool. I mean, I don't know. I was on there today. I was like kind of looking around, and it seems like there's a lot more technical tech. If you're a tech savvy person, there's probably a lot more things you can do. I saw that there was a spot for blogs, which was cool. I thought that would be a pretty cool feature. If you know, I know how. Morelia people like to talk about their snakes, so that was cool. You know, like I said, I'm just glad it's back, and it's kind of like, I don't know, I can equate it to a girlfriend, and I remember thinking, I'll never go back to Facebook.
God.
I'll never go back to Facebook, you know, like when a girl's gone and, you know, you're missing her.
Keep going. This is priceless. Keep going.
Yeah.
I'm loving it.
Anyway, yeah, I'm just glad it's back. And, yeah, like you said, big thanks to Sean.
Which,
and,
of course, I mean, with it being back now, it means that the calendar competition is now back on track. But, of course, it means that now you and I have to look at both the Facebook page and MP to make sure that in case there's a photo that's not on both. And, yeah, it's, either way, it's glad to have everything back up and running.
Yeah, it's cool. I got, what else do I have? We're going to, just so everybody knows, you can go to either spots. Like, just like Owen said, you can go to mp.com to post up your pictures. And we extended, or you can go to the, we can go to the Facebook page, Murray Python Radio Group, and you can put them over there. But we extended it until the 19th. So you have until November 19th to get those pictures in, and we'll be good to go. What else do I have? Tonight we have Steve Tillis from Reptilis Herps coming on. We met him at ICAS. He has his own thing going on. I know he used to do the show Reptile Talk, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we go. But he's got a lot of lot of different species he works with, and he works with Eugene Bissett. So should be cool to talk to him and see what's going on there. What else? Anything new with you?
Nothing new with us, just kind of going through the motions of the breeding year. What's cool is that poking around the website and the pick of the week in the forums, I don't know if you saw Casper post a picture of his Scream Jag, one of his foldbacks, I think. The hell going on with that thing? I mean, I think he explained to me once what the hell was in the Scream Jag. So I think it's like a diamond brittle jag. Right? Okay, so it's got diamond, brittle, and coastal.
Yeah.
Okay. Ridiculous. I mean, ridiculous color, ridiculousness. I mean, damn him. That's pretty. So I figure I would give Casper that nice little bit of a shout-out, and he can, you know, do his Viking thing, whatever he does over there. So, but that was pretty, and... I'm seeing, I don't know about you, but every once in a while, I'm sorry, I had to take a drink, easy. Every once in a while, whenever you're like, all right, I'm done, I'm not going to buy any more snakes right now, that's when everything you want appears on the goddamn for sale or just there. Because now I'm like, there are Aussie water pythons on the market. I've seen Bismarck rings on the market. It's like, oh, goddamn it. So... please, for the love of God, let winter come so I can justify by like, oh, I can't buy them. It's January. Shipping will kill it. Hooray. Yeah. So hopefully that'll come through. But we're just hunkering down.
Purchase-wise, what would be your next purchase? Put money aside, all that aside, and availability and all that kind of stuff.
Roughies.
Rough scales are your
done.
Next.
Done. Okay. That's my next big thing. I'm thinking that, you know, the 2013 babies that are still freaking here and the subsequent 2014 season is just going to be that, you know, sell those and finally get my rough scale babies, because I'm pretty sure people are starting to get really annoyed that I keep talking about it. So, you know.
Yeah, I can equate you to rough scales like I equate David Kelly to diamond pythons.
But he got his diamond pythons.
I know. Correct. He beat you to it, man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's what he wanted. I don't give a damn what he wants.
Oh, man, he's beating you to
it.
I
want what I want. And diamonds are on my list. Just rough scales are above it because of my personal preference. Thank you.
Hey, man, all the power.
I'll get it. Shut up. I'll get them. I'll get them soon.
What's that? Ruffies or diamonds?
Yeah, both.
Both.
Let's go both.
Yeah.
Both. Both.
What else? What did I see that was going on?
When are you getting diamonds? You don't have any diamonds.
Hopefully soon. Yeah. Hopefully soon. I don't know. Yeah.
I turned it around on you right now. So,
I guess the next thing that I have coming is my albino jag thing from Paul that I got from last year, and he's coming from Nick soon. But it would be
what
the next
date time. When will you not be home?
And it's supposedly it's can't remember if you said it was all orange or if it was all yellow. I think he said it was all yellow. Yeah, it was like solid yellow, you know. I guess that's just...
What is up with the colors of albino? Aren't they a little weird?
I think they're awesome, man, you know, because they're not like your typical albino, but I never was a really big fan of albino snakes in general, but for some reason, there's two that I really dig. One was the carpet python, and it was before I was even into, you know, carpets big time. But carpet albino just, I don't know, man. They had a multi, I guess because of the variability of carpet pythons in general. And then you put, you know, albino on top of that, and who knows what you're going to get. So I don't even think we've seen the potential of what we can do with the albino gene.
Oh, hell no. And my question is that, now we do know that there's an albino coastal in Australia. Eventually, the albino coastals come through and, you know, make that swim that they tend to do to Europe. Are you going to see different, like, are you going to see a dramatic difference between the Darwin albino jags and the pure coastal albino jags? Because remember, that albino coastal down in Australia was, like, pink.
I guess it depends on where the coastals are from. I mean... Really, if that was from the northern part of the coastal range, I would say no. It would be very similar to what you see in the Darwin. Maybe to the southern, you might see a change. I'm not sure.
Who knows? I don't know.
Cool.
We'll see.
Two albinos, though. That's kind of like...
Will that really mess with the market like the same way the pure albino Darwins did to the mutts?
Well, one, I would be curious if they're compatible. I would imagine they would be. I don't see why they wouldn't. Mm. But, you know, I don't know. So that's that, yeah. Albino berms were, you know, but only when albino berms are babies. You know, they're like orange and white and they got the high contrast.
It pops up and then it kind of fades a little when they get older.
Yeah, I really like that. That's why I'm working towards the albino citrus tiger. I think that I'll be able to replicate that into adulthood with some selective breeding. So we shall see. One of the cool things why the forum was down, I decided to venture over to the Bush League Breeders Club and check out. I haven't been there in a long, long time. I posted up some of my IJs, and Jake Milbratt, he got in contact with me, and he actually produced Poison Ivy, my melanin the guy jay.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was actually, I was so excited, man, because I've never thought in a million years that I'd be able to find any kind of backstory on that snake. And he contacted me up, and, you know, he checked with Anthony Caponetto because apparently he sold it to Anthony Caponetto, and then Anthony Caponetto turned around and sold it to Kurt Finnegan, and that's who I picked her up from. He sent me pictures of the mom, you know, the sire and the dam. And the sire, he's dark, but the dam is a spitting image of her. So,
okay.
I don't know, man. I'm really, my fingers are crossed this year that there's something there. If anything, I can, you know, selectively breed towards it. But I kind of feel like, you know, Brian Barczyk with the scaleless ball python because it's missing a couple of scales on the top of its head. He's making the stretch to get
and
it.
And it comes out and it works out.
You know?
Yeah.
So the thing I like, the thing I dig about, you know, there's two things that I like about Poison Ivy. One, she still has a white face, so it really kind of pops, you know. And then, two, she has a brown stripe down her back. So if I can replicate that and really like make that pop out, then I thought about what happens when you breed it to the Exanic. Oh man, you know it's going to be like a charcoal. Gray snake. I don't know. That's going to be
hopefully.
So
basically, if you're in the United States and you're at a reptile show and you see and almost all black INJ mail. Buy it and ship it to Eric. He will buy it from you immediately. Money is no object to this man, and he will pay whatever price you have. So you're like, whoa now.
Slow down, Owen.
Remember there was that one reptile show where I saw that really dark IJ, and I didn't comment. I didn't even think about it until I was like in the car leaving. I'm like, oh shit, if that was a boy, I should have got it for Eric. And then I told you, you're like, what show? Who was it? What's wrong with you? I'm like, I'm sorry. So, yeah.
I think I hit you with a chair or something like that.
I think you threw something at me. It was, you know, you didn't speak to me unless it was about the radio show for a month at least. Yeah, it was something like that. So.
But, yeah, so I don't know. You know, I don't know. I hope. So this year I'm going to try to breed it to a dark IJ that I have, and he's had Greg, so, but who cares? But he's the darkest IJ that I have. I know,
he's
I really don't care.
No one gives a damn.
I don't really care about the granite thing. That's kind of just like a bonus type of thing. I'm just trying to replicate the black IJ. But and then the following year, I'm going to try to breed it to either going to try to do an exanic, if I can get a visual male, and then maybe do a lighter colored IJ to see what happens with that clutch. So
he's a black come through. I got you.
Yeah. So cool. Who knows?
And you know, it might end up just being that you might have to raise up one of her sons to have to cross back to see if there's any kind of genetic variability here. You might be making the project up as you go along. I mean, you might not find a boy, but you might make a boy that's suitable for what you need.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. That's crossing my fingers and hoping for the best. And if not, you know, like I said, she's a cool snake, man. So
it's a fun project regardless, because it gets you stuff to do and gets your gears turning and gets you enjoying your whole collection. So more power to you.
Yeah, when I was talking to Jake yesterday, we were going back and forth, and he was giving me some of the back history on it. And one of the things that I started thinking about it, so I tried to look up, like, I figured ball pythons would probably be the easiest place to find, like, an all black ball python, to see what that looked like what were some of the markers in the python that made that snake, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm looking at it, and I don't even remember the morph names or whatever. They're not like your mainstream ones, like, you know.
No, it's too hard. Yeah.
It was some like new, I guess if you're a ball python enthusiast, you would know about it. But so that's why I don't know what it was called. But anyway, I'm looking at the morph, and then I click to, like, you know, this is the super, and then I click to like the codon version of it. And I'm like looking at it, like, it just looks like a normal ball python. I don't get it. I don't get it. And I'm
what
like,
is it?
Those guys, they just look at this thing and they're like, oh, one little scale's out of place, and they're like, oh, that's a morph. Boom, breed it, and then.
You see, I would know what to do. Well, the problem is like, you know, and imagine they're looking at us. Is it like, you know, Pied has a marker. Het Pieds have markers. They're looking at us, they're like, how do you know if the INJ is het granite? You don't. You breed it. That's stupid. I mean, yeah. It can go two ways here. So
that's that. And the only other thing I wanted to read before we bring Steve on as well, you know, I like to read, get emails and such. So this came from Nathan Troy. But it says, hey, Eric and Owen, just wanted to say that I love the radio show. You and Owen do an awesome job, and I'm totally hooked. I only came across it a couple of months ago after they started Reptile Radio Australia over here. But, man, you guys have had great guests, and information that you're getting out there is incredible. I've only been keeping pythons for the last 5 years, and more seriously over the last 3 years, but I am addicted like everyone else that gets into Morelia. This is the first season breeding. I have two clutches cooking at the moment, so fingers crossed for some albino Darwins in late November.
Oh, my God.
Keep up top-notch jobs. that you two are doing. I hang out for the show every week. Side note, he loves the music at the end of each episode. Cheers, Nathan. So, you know.
Yeah.
And he,
Darwin's kill myself.
He wants us to bring on some more Australian guests, so we'll have to work on that for him. But, Troy,
we will have to.
Best of luck with your...
I don't think we've had anybody on since that one, since Damien's one went haywire, right?
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, we gotta get give some love down there to the our Aussie brothers and sisters, and we'll have to get them. So yeah, like I said, Nathan, best of luck with your season. Hope you hatch out all albino Darwins, and you know, thanks for the love. And by the way, Joe Satriani is usually the guy that is the music at the end of the show, in case you're wondering. So. So that's that.
We keep throwing it up there. It's a mix.
Yeah. So I don't know. That's all I got, really. I guess to get this. Oh, one more thing. Did you see the video of the Owen Pelly's python on the rock?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Did you grab it? Grab it. Bring it here.
I'm like, oh, man, look at that thing.
I think. Somebody went like, it's like a water python mixed with a scrub. I'm like, no, it's like an Owen Pelly python on a rock. What do we know?
Yeah. Yeah. So cool stuff. Yeah. That's a dream snake of mine. But one day.
It'll get there eventually. Imagine it this way. At one point, the rough scale was never going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, it was the rarest of the rare. And now they're like, they breed too much. Here,
yeah.
Like, eventually going to be welcome to the Australian Snake Show. Here's a rough scale python with your purchase and a kid's meal. So, yeah, I mean, this is how it's going to go.
Yeah.
Eventually. So,
good stuff. All right, I guess without further ado, let's get Steve on here and get this going. Hey, Steve, welcome to Morelia Python Radio. Glad to have you.
No, thanks for having me. How are you guys doing tonight?
Oh, doing quite well.
Absolutely.
So, Steve, obviously you should know the drill. I don't know if Eugene told you the whole deal, but first thing we want to know is what got you started in reptiles?
Well, I mean, as with just about anyone, it traces back pretty much to the very beginning. My granddaddy actually lived on a wildlife management area down here in South Florida, and so he kind of got me into thinking about animals and stuff as a whole, but one of my earliest memories is with him going out and catching a corn snake, and it was in the coil of the garden hose, and we caught it and stuck it in a big pretzel jar, and I kept it for a day or two, and I think I fed it a lizard, and so I kept the poor thing for like 2 or 3 days, and then so I was going to go to let it go, and I was going to show off to everyone how much I had learned, so the poor snake in this little pretzel jar, and I stick my hand in there, and the snake's coiling up, you know, clearly defensive, and I'm not paying attention, and then the thing strikes out and bites me on the finger, and instead of me freaking out, it just, for some reason, just got me hooked on snakes, and then, you know, one thing leads to another, and I think I was 13, I sold off my Lego collection for like $400 and bought my first pair of ball pythons, and then, you know, the rest is history.
Awesome. Excellent use of Legos. That's good. Would you agree to say that it's exposure to reptiles at a young age is important?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, whenever I think back, I can still see it plain as day, that snake just sitting there and striking out and then biting my finger, and I look at my finger and there's a drop of blood on it, and I'm like, what just happened? But yeah, it's just something clicks inside you.
That's good. That's cool. All right. So you ended up working with Eugene Bissett, and of course, you know, you were down with us at ICAST yucking it up with Eugene, and we brought him on to the show. How did you end up working with him?
That's sort of a funny story in and of itself. So back in Orlando, which is where I'm from, we have a pet store there, and I'd always go in and I'd always hear this name, Eugene Bissett, being thrown around. And I'd been to all the expos and I'd never seen him, so I didn't have a face to connect with the name. So I was 16, I think it was, and somehow I managed to breed green tree pythons for the first time at 16, which I thought was just the biggest deal at the time. So I'm at this expo in Orlando vending a table, and I have these little baby green trees out on my table, and then I see this guy walking by, and he stops, and he looks at the green trees, and he looks at me, and he says, "Oh, those are some nice-looking snakes." And then I, you know, wasn't paying attention. I looked up, and I said, "Thank you," and I looked at his name tag, and it said Eugene, and I was like, I stopped for a second. I was like, "Are you Eugene Bissett?" And he's like, "Yeah, why?" And I was like, "Oh, my gosh, I've heard your name so many times, but I've never had a face to connect to the name." So I get to talking with him, and he invited me up to go check out his facility up in Gainesville. So I ended up going randomly sometime in the week. And once I graduated from high school, I got into the University of Florida up here in Gainesville. And so I basically had to make the choice of if I wanted to sell off everything or try to buy a house up here and keep on breeding the snakes, because obviously, you know, living in a dorm, that probably wouldn't be practical. So I started coming up here pretty much every weekend of senior year of high school and talking with Eugene and basically planning out what the best areas to look for property are. And so I actually ended up buying a house just down the street from Eugene. And I was like, "Well, while I'm up here, do you need any help?" And so I just started working for him over the summer once I moved
up
here.
That's fantastic. So glad that worked out. I love how Eugene's like, "Yeah, why?"
Yeah, that's, for anyone who's met Eugene, you can just picture him, his face when he says that.
Yeah, which is funny. So, you just wander down the street and go help him out and work every once in a while, or what do you do
down
there?
As the crow flies, I'm probably about half a mile down the street from him. This area really stood out to me. It's a great area to buy some property, so we actually ended up buying a 5-acre property out here, and you know, I have freedom to do whatever I want. And then, you know, by the end of college, if I decide I want to do this full time, I have a great platform to do this full time. Or if I decide, you know, it's not something I want to do, I can sell the property. And just because we bought at the low of the market, and, you know, hopefully by the time I graduate, the market's a little bit better, but I can almost make enough revenue off selling the house to pay for college. So it was definitely a win-win, and it just worked out perfectly. All the stars aligned, as it were.
That's fantastic. So, so what are your you care for the animals for Eugene, and what are some of the animals that you help out with his collection?
Well, it's been changing a lot this year. Like I said, I'm a full-time student at UF. I'm a wildlife ecology and conservation major, so that really sucks up a lot of my time. Plus, I mean, I have a fairly decent-sized collection of my own that's certainly been growing over the past year. Last year, I handled a lot of the breeding of some of the ball pythons in one of his rooms, and just a lot of the day-to-day stuff like that. This semester, because I've been so much more busy and school's really picking up, I've mostly just been managing some of his online stuff. I manage his Facebook and then some of the Kingsnake ads and stuff like that. So that's really where I've been a help, I think, to him, just being able to manage that for him.
Which I wish I had somebody to do that crap. But, that's very cool. And I like the major. That was my original major when I went to college. So cool. So your company, why don't you tell us what you're doing over at, Reptilis Herps? Give us a basic overview of what you got running on down there.
Well, right now, predominantly, my main focus is blood pythons. My collection is probably about half blood pythons at this point, and I have all three different species of bloods and short-tail pythons. But and my collection is also probably about 25% carpets, and then the rest are all mixes of I have quite a few ball pythons, a handful of green tree pythons, a pair of womas, some white-lipped pythons, a pair of spotted pythons, a pair of Angolan pythons. So a little bit of a mix, but really I'd say 75% of my collection is either bloods or carpets.
What species of white-lipped?
I have the gold phase.
Okay. Cool.
Awesome. Cool stuff. Well,
One of the things that I always wanted to talk to you about, Steve, was the whole flat temp thing, and or the quote-unquote Terry Phillip method, if you will. And a lot of people, I can say that as of trying it the past year, didn't really work that well for me. I don't know if that was the reason or, you know, I don't know. I wasn't sure really what was the problem. But can you tell us your thoughts on the whole flat temp method and keeping reptiles and your thoughts on thermoregulation and what you think is going on there?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I was first introduced to this method when I was listening to Reptile Radio and heard Dave and Tracy Barker of VPI talking about it. So I always learned as the VPI method, and then when Terry Phillips came on and was talking about his thoughts on it as well, it kind of confirmed it for me. But I started out keeping the animals just like everyone else, and it kind of came about through necessity. Basically, what happened was I had a close friend who had a decent-sized collection as well, who ended up going through a divorce, and basically I had to take over a large chunk of his collection basically overnight. So my collection pretty much doubled overnight, and there was just no way to keep up with that amount of heat tape and that amount of heat cable. I simply didn't have enough. So I just started putting heaters in the room and just said, well, I guess this is going to have to work. And you know, I just kept it running like that and found out that it did work pretty well. I run my room a little bit hotter than Terry Phillips or VPI. I probably keep it at around 83 to 84. But yeah, it's worked really well for me. I have a big window in my room, so I think the majority of my cycling is really off of flight cycles or barometric pressure. But beyond that, yeah, I haven't touched a thermostat in years. It's very nice.
Very cool. So what's your thoughts? We'll go a little bit more into that, because as far as light cycles go, like what's your thinking there? Why do you think light cycles affect? And what are you doing as far as light cycles for breeding? And does it go across all the species that you keep?
Yeah, absolutely. There's not a single species that isn't kept in this method. And, you know, I used to think light cycles was probably the majority of it, but actually after talking to some people, like, one of the most interesting case studies for me has got to be Bill Brandt at the Gourmet Rodent, and he's the breeder that supplies Petco, but his business is based out of some large warehouses, but the warehouses have no windows, and it keeps all the snakes indoors, no windows, and using a flatline temperature, no temperature cycling or anything. So he basically gets clutches year-round, and he breeds exclusively using the ultrasound, but they get no light cycling and no temp cycling, and so... And his seasonality is actually very interesting, because he will get clutches year-round, but he definitely has a peak right when everyone else has a peak, around July or so. So I think a lot of it has got to be barometric pressure. And light cycles definitely play into that, but it's all part of the seasonality. I think these animals have a natural sense of what time of year it is, and it's really hard to kind of beat that out of them, even when you keep them in an environment where they're not being stimulated either temperature-wise, light-wise, or anything really.
Right. Yeah, I think the method works. I think that the only issue, I tweaked it a bit, and I pretty much followed it the year before. The first year I bred, I kind of followed it, but just with a very minimal basking spot. So my basking spot was probably 83 to 85 degrees. And then my ambient temp was maybe 78 to 80 degrees. So it's basically right in line with what's going on there. But my thought, and maybe you can delve more into this, but I guess my thought is there's a little more to it than just, you know, just keeping at those standard temperatures. Do you see them? Do you see any of your pythons breeding outside of the quote-unquote or ovulating outside of the normal season?
Oh, yeah. No, certainly it's part of it. I mean, you will notice absolutely a peak seasonality, but with this method, that is one thing I've noticed. You get more outliers in terms of animals going at weird times of the year. Like right now I have a gravid Woma python that ovulated like less than a month ago, and for a Woma python to breed this time of year is really atypical. So you definitely do get outliers like that, but the majority definitely fall within the normal window.
Okay.
The other thing, like I said, what I have noticed is that you do get more outliers, but also that your season runs a little bit longer. So you will have a peak, but your peak stretches out a little bit longer than you would if you were just going off of, you know, your basic Python breeding recipe.
Okay. Okay. So I guess when a storm comes through or you're getting a change in pressure, you're putting your pairs together right at then, or what do you, how does that work for you?
As free time dictates. I mean, naturally when I see storms coming in, I try to throw them together, but, you know, it really just depends on, it's all about reading the animal. And that's one thing that I picked up from Eugene is just, you know, student of the serpent. It's just a matter of, knowing your animals. And if you get good enough, you can walk into the room at any time of the year and just pick up the animal, and you know, you have a good idea of where you think they are in development. And you'll get some that just completely stump you, but for like 90% of the snakes, you can just walk in there and pick them up, and you're like, okay, I know where she's at.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And maybe you're a good person to probably answer this question, but a lot of people, I use that quote a lot too, and because I learned that from Eugene when he was on Reptile Radio. I thought that was such an awesome quote, student of the serpent. But what kind of advice can you give the new guy or new girl getting into breeding pythons, as far as like how you can work on some tips or tricks on how you can develop an eye for seeing what's going on with your snakes?
The biggest thing I think is to actually feel the snake. I mean, it's such a routine thing that you don't even think about it, but every time you clean the cage for a week, you know, every time you go through and clean the cage, just pick up the snake. And after a while, it may take a year or two to really build it up, but after a while, you can feel that snake. You can feel if there's something wrong with it. You can feel if it's sick. You can feel if it's firm. You can feel if it's, you know, you just laying your hands on the animal is probably speaks wonders as to figuring them out.
Okay. All right. That's a good idea. What about shed cycles? I know when Terry was talking about this whole thing, one of the things that he said that he watches for is shed cycles. Does that play into your breeding season? Are you paying attention to that? Or
Yes and no. I mean, certainly there are I mean, it makes sense. When an animal sheds, it's going to be shedding out. We've all know that kind of like milky white substance that's, you know, kind of helps the shed come off a little bit easier, that, you know, turns the eyes cloudy. But, and it makes sense that with that secretion comes some sort of pheromone signal and stuff like that. So it makes sense certainly to throw animals together either after they've shed or close to it. But basically, you can tell a lot from an animal sheds, but there are basically two main sheds that you really look for, and that's obviously the pre-lay shed right before they lay, but before
right.
they ovulate, they shed as well, and that's another good thing to look for. That in conjunction with, like, you know, females laying inverted or they just feel firm, that can definitely be very strong signals as to where an animal's at in development. But much beyond that, at off times of the year, I mean, I really don't pay that much attention to shedding.
Okay. Well, I think one of the things that I guess is good to mention in this part for maybe people just getting into it is I've been fooled by the shed before the ovulation shed. I don't know if you guys ever been duped by that shed, but I guess because the female starts to swell because she's, you know, it's kind of like the, and then you're kind of thrown off and your time frame is thrown off. Has that ever happened to you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But it's better to be overly cautious than it is to be mistaken. Like, it's easy to see that and mistake it for a prelay shed. But, I mean, once you wait a little bit and then you see the thing ovulate and then shed again, I mean, it becomes pretty obvious. So it's not like, I don't see that as being harmful. I just see that as being overly watchful, which in some cases is definitely a good thing. I don't think it's detrimental to mistake that.
Oh, no, absolutely not. But it just can throw you off if it's the first time you're doing it, for sure. One of the things that I saw on, I guess it was Facebook maybe I saw you using an ultrasound, and I know you were saying, I forget who you just mentioned, but you're talking about that they use an ultrasound with this method as well. Do you use an ultrasound doing this method?
I just got my ultrasound like 2 weeks ago, so I haven't used it full scale for breeding. Really, I got it because looking into some work with tegus and stuff like that as far as their reproduction and how that might relate to some of the invasive problems here in Florida. But with the ultrasound, I will say just in the 2 weeks that I've had it, 90% of the time you're going to think it's an absolute waste of money because it's not going to tell you anything you don't know. But it's that 10% of snakes that just don't breed within the normal windows or just that don't show the signs as well. You can really gain a lot of insight with the ultrasound. I mean, it helps you catch more of those outliers that seem to pop up.
Right, right.
And that goes with any collection, not just with, you know, the Terry Phillips method.
I would imagine, I hope one day that I can get an ultrasound because my thought would be it would be very beneficial in using in breeding some of the more harder to breed species of pythons, some of the scrubs, bolans, et cetera, stuff like that. So I think that would be a huge tool. So, Owen, we're going to split the cost of that. And
yes,
I just didn't
it'd
tell
be
you
fun
yet.
To ultrasound things. I mean,
yeah.
We can just ultrasound anything after that point. I mean, I'm going to eat a quarter and then see if I can find it.
Yeah, exactly. go ahead.
Yeah, I definitely would recommend the ultrasound. It is very interesting, but I wouldn't use it as an exclusive breeding tool. Now, again, going back to Bill Brandt, the Gourmet Rodent, one of the coolest things, it's interesting. I don't know if I would be gutsy enough to try it, but this is mainly talking about his ball python colony, but basically he doesn't breed a female until they hit 12-millimeter follicles. So he'll basically have racks full of females, and once they hit 12 millimeters, then he'll start breeding them. So his isn't even based on what time of year it is or what time of or what the weather is or anything like that. It's exclusively based on the size of the female's follicles. He doesn't even factor in those other elements. So I think that's interesting and certainly says a lot as to, you know, really basing reproduction off of the animal. Now, whether or not, like I said, I personally wouldn't try that method, but it certainly is interesting.
Oh, yeah, it is. Absolutely. Now, as far as, like, how's your success been with this way? I mean, are you 100% what you try to breed, you get?
Anyone on any real numbers isn't 100%, but
sure.
I think I do pretty well, but I really don't have that large of a collection per se, so it's not like I have hundreds of clutches to really base this data off of, but I probably hit, over the course of a year, about 80%.
Okay. That's still pretty good.
Yeah. That's
now,
not bad.
Are you getting slugs or anything like that?
That's one of the most interesting things. Now, I don't know if this just speaks personally as to my collection or just because of the breeding method that I use, but I can honestly count in any given year the number of slugs on one hand. I mean, the only time I'll get slugs are, like I had some of the slugs in the Brettles clutch, but that I don't base off of any fault of the female. I base that off of the male only paired with her once. So it's more likely not enough sperm to fertilize all the eggs. So I think that's the only time I run into slugs. Otherwise, I might get one or two periodically placed throughout clutches randomly. But I've never had a female ever slug out, and certainly never more than half the clutch.
Huh. And it's interesting that you're saying that with Brettles, because usually, typically, Brettles are one of those species that you have to bring down to the 50s in order to have any kind of success with them.
Right. But the problem I've seen with Brettles is that, because my female is proven, not with me, but she was proven with Mike Curtin, and she had a clutch, and it was apparently 6 slugs with 1 good egg. So, and he attributed to that it didn't get down low enough. his temperature, so I don't know.
See, for me, it was this female's kind of just an oddball female. It took me a while to raise her up, but I mean that's mm-hmm. pretty much holds true for all Brettles. But she was one of the ones I tried breeding her early on in the year because everyone says, you know, Brettles breed early on in the year, and I wasn't getting any action out of her, so I pretty much just gave up on it. And then later on in the year, I noticed she started feeling a little bit firm, and I was like, well, I might as well just throw a male in there with her. And I hadn't seen any action out of the male at all with this female, and within about 10 minutes, I placed him in there, and he paired up with her right away. So, you know, then I could tell she was onto something. And you know, a lot of times I think it's just the presence of a male. I do think that pythons are induced ovulators, and the presence of a male can really do wonders. So basically off that one pairing, she ovulated shortly thereafter. So sometimes all it takes is one pairing, but that would be why I would assume the fertility of that clutch was relatively low. I mean, I got about she was a small female. I think I got 7 good eggs and then 4 or 5 slugs.
Not bad.
Yeah.
I take cool. it and run.
I guess when it comes to this method as well, do you do any kind of seasonal feeding, or are you just, what's your feeding regimen like, just general?
See, that's kind of a loaded question because I breed my own rats, and anyone who breeds their own rats will tell you that your production will change periodically throughout the year in terms of the weather. Sometimes the rats will respond better or worse. So really my feeding is based on the response of my rats to the weather more than the snakes. So it's almost like the weather could be influencing my snakes indirectly by influencing the rats, which I then feed to the snakes in varying quantities depending on how much supply I have at any given time of the year. But certainly not on any massive scale. It's not like I just completely stopped feeding them at one point in a year. I basically just feed it when I have it. And right now, you know, with the coolish weather, I'm producing a lot of rats right now, so I'm really pounding them. But, yeah, past that, there's really not any rhyme or reason to it.
Huh. Just a little bit off topic for a second. I didn't realize that you bred your own rodents, and I don't know if we've ever had anybody on here. I've often thought about doing that, but
Nick does.
Yeah, he does. That's right. Is it worth it? Is it worth the work? I mean, what's your thoughts on that? How difficult is it to get it going?
It depends on what kind of scale you want to do it on.
Okay.
But at this point, I couldn't imagine not breeding my own rodents. And at this point, I don't even really clean the rodents. I pay someone to do that, and it's still about 3 times as economical as going out to buy rodents. I really couldn't imagine it any other way.
Okay.
That, and you just have much tighter control on what you're feeding your animals, and you know where your stock is coming from. But honestly, I love it. If I was able to build a business and go 100% full-time, it would be based off of rats more than it would on snakes.
Yeah, the rat guys always sell out every show.
Yeah,
it's really not that bad. It's just you have to have land to do it. That's there's no way you could possibly try to do it in your house or in a environment where you're close to your neighbors. I mean, I have plenty of space out here, so I can really crank out a good production. But I really couldn't imagine doing it any other way.
Right. Because of the smell stuff like that?
It's a couple of different factors. I mean, one, there's a smell, but if you're good at it, the smell really isn't all that bad.
Okay.
But most of it is just you want to get a barrier around yourself in terms of just peeking eyes and stuff like that. Like one of the things Eugene always says that a lot of people I don't really think are listening to is when he says, buy land. And that certainly could not be more true the more I look at it. I mean, you want to get yourself out into agricultural areas where, you know, farming really is mainstream. And because if you tried to do this in some sort of like – because when I was growing up in Orlando, I mean, we lived on a third of an acre. And I was always paranoid that the neighbors were going to, like, you know, even catch one little smell, even though it wasn't, like, overpowering, just one little smell, or they're going to see me out there working the rats, or just basically anything to give it away, and then they go to a homeowners association, and then that's
right.
The end to my dream. So it's all
right.
It's all about land, and it's all about agricultural land. So that's,
yeah,
that's
makes
my
sense.
Personal feeling on it.
Yeah. Huh. Okay.
Yeah, that is the reason I don't take pictures of my snakes outside. I don't want anybody checking out the carpet python and calling the bureau of the borough or council and getting me kicked out. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and 99% of people are going to have no problem with it or a little problem with it, but all it takes is that one person who might not even be, who might be like, you know, dozens of houses down from you that just happens to...
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, because,
you know,
my neighbors
make,
know,
make
and they've
change.
All come and checked it out, but, you know, next thing you need is that one person that lives three blocks away who's convinced that one of my pythons is going to escape and some for their children in the night. So, yeah. No, thank you. So.
Do you breed just rats or rats and mice?
I breed rats, mice, soft furs, and I do have one tray of the little dwarf hamsters now, but predominantly rats, and actually I feed a lot of soft furs. I love my soft furs. I've spent just ridiculous amounts of time and energy on my soft furs as far as develop. Like, my goal right now, because if you look at them, as far as a feeder rodent, I mean, soft furs, they just have insane litter sizes, and they're the perfect size for just about anything. I love soft furs. They're probably my favorite feeder, but currently with the USDA, they're not considered like a domestic rodent, like a mouse or a rat. They're considered like an African mammal, like a, you know, like anything, like some of the Gambian pouched rats. So the legislation surrounding them is just completely different. So I spent the better part of a year getting other people's strains of soft furs and kind of reverse engineering it and trying to create a lab strain of soft furs that are more domesticated than, you know, your typical soft fur, to really kind of push for them to be considered more as a domestic rodent than an African rodent, you know. So it took me a long time, but I basically got to the point where all of my soft furs are 100% white with red eyes. They're tame. I also had a problem with tumors coming about in the soft furs, so I kind of like somehow managed to breed that out. So I spent like the better part of a year just trying to create as close as I could as a lab strain of soft fur, just to give myself that leverage someday down the road if I decide to try to start a rodent breeding business. That way I could at least leverage them as a domestic rodent and not a African rodent, you know?
Right.
Sure.
How are they to deal with? I mean, how are they? Are they a little more on the aggressive side, or?
They certainly can be. My strain has been really good. They don't bite me any more frequently than like a mouse does, but they stand up to the heat a lot better. And like I said, their litter sizes are. Mice can probably have litter sizes as far as like record breaking litters, but as far as predictably large litters where they don't end up eating all their pinkies or like half of them die or something like that, soft furs are really predictable, good breeders, especially if you're trying to produce a lot of pinkies.
Right. Okay. Are they, I often hear that soft furs are good with, especially with picky carpet pythons. I think Nick is the one that told me that, but they're pretty good at, they take them right away. Do you see that with a lot of your pythons?
They're good for picky anything, just about. And there's a lot of rumors around soft furs that, like, about snakes getting hooked on soft furs. And honestly, I think that's BS. I switched them back and forth from soft furs to rats in a number of different species. Usually a picky snake is going to be a picky snake, whether it's soft furs, mice, whatever. I don't feel that soft furs have any higher risk of becoming addicting to a snake than, like, mice or anything else.
Okay.
But for Peggy Peter, there's nothing better. They really do work.
I have to consider that.
And the other benefit to them is that the odor is a lot less for those guys.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's cool, but after years of working in a laboratory, no dice, I ain't breeding my own rodents. So, more power to you. So.
Let me ask, before you jump in the carpets, and I have one more thing that I want to ask about rodents. When did you decide? Like, what's the what would you say collection size wise would be the where it becomes more beneficial to breed your own rodents? Are you talking like 50 snakes, 100 snakes, 200 snakes? Like, what's your thoughts on that?
I don't even know if there is a good minimum size to really start breeding your own rodents. I think I started when I had like 20 snakes. I probably would have started before that if my parents had been more open about it or open to it. So,
okay.
I think you can be economical at all different levels. The trickiest and hardest part is simply finding a secure and economical source of rodent feed. And I'm not talking about dog food or the little, bag of corn or whatever. Like, you need a legitimate rodent food if you want to actually do it efficiently.
Right.
It's worth the extra money. You definitely will feel the increase in efficiency, and it just makes you more legitimate if you're actually using, like, a rodent block, but that's definitely the most challenging part.
Okay. Why? Is that difficult to come by?
It certainly can be, especially in different parts of the country. And but the hardest part is finding it, like I said, economically. I used to be able to, back in Orlando, go to my local feed store, and I could pay $25 for a bag of Missouri, and it took me the better part of a year to track down somewhere where I could just buy it at the ton instead of having to buy a bag at a time at $25 a piece and save myself $10 a bag. So it takes a lot of time and kind of a lot of phone calls to really track down a good source to get it for a good price.
Right. Okay. All right. Cool. Go ahead, Owen.
Thank you, Eric. So, Stephen, let's get to the nitty-gritty, the lovely part, carpet pythons. What you working with?
My carpet collection is not huge right now. I pretty much have all of the most common morphs minus albinos at this point, and that's definitely next on my list. So I have, buckets of jags and, a handful of zebra stuff, some zebra jags, a couple of granite girls. I have some diamond stuff that I think, one diamond jungle female that I think is really pretty spectacular, some tiger stuff, and then I picked up that super caramel from you. But beyond that, I'm still at the ingredient phase. I haven't really started basically, I started out my carpet colony with a ivory jungle jag from Will from Mike Curtin. And so I think my first year breeding jags, I produced like 20-something jags, so I held back like 5 females from that, and this will be the first year they're up to size, so a lot of my stuff is still young and growing up, so I haven't really started hitting the production on the carpets yet.
That sounds like a hell of a collection already, and did you got a tiger eye cast as well from Jason Balin, correct?
No, I picked up that tiger a couple of years ago from Jason. I picked up some zebra stuff from Jason and some tiger stuff, and then I think the Diamond Cross was from Headhunter, I want to say.
So you're spending the time and you're getting the good stuff from the right people, which is a good way to go. So,
well, basically, as far as the carpet market is concerned, down here in Florida, there's nothing. It took me, once the zebras were produced pretty commonly, it still took me years. I've only seen one ever pop up in Florida. And that was when they had already dropped to like, $1,500 a piece. Then I saw one in Florida, and I haven't seen one since. So as far as carpets go, there's really basically nothing in Florida. So what I would do is fly up to Chicago or some of the expos up north to really buy carpets up there, because you have literally nothing to pick from except for, you know, your random Jaguar with no real background information or anything like that, at least as experts go. And, you know, when I'm picking animals, I really love to pick them in person. So I flew up to Chicago and spent a lot of money on zebras and all that stuff, really, to grow the collection.
Fantastic. So looking at your collection and the age that they're growing, what year is going to be your be-all, end-all year when everything is, you know, all the stuff you've been waiting on is ready to go?
This year will be an interesting one. This is the first year where I probably have about a dozen girls that are big enough to breed. But they're all going to be virgins, and I'm actually female heavy.
That's a terrible, terrible situation. Jesus Christ.
I only have a couple of males, and like one of them just randomly rolled on me. So I think for this year, the only male, I had one male big enough to run to like a dozen girls. So I ended up getting another one from a friend of mine, another male. But yeah, you can't run, I don't care how good you are, you can't run one male carpet to a dozen females. So,
Oh, hell no.
Yeah, so this year will be interesting because some of the girls I think are going to go, certainly not all of them, but I think next year is going to be really the biggest year because I should have some zebra females up to size and some granite females. Right now, this year, it's going to be all jag stuff and various crosses like that.
Well, that's awesome. So hopefully, you know, so next year is the year that, you know, everything kind of comes through. I mean, I know everybody has that quintessential year when all that stuff you've been growing is finally ready and good to go. So
still ain't there yet.
it certainly can snowball on me. I mean, every year I have more and more females come online of a bunch of different species. So it's it's just a matter of kind of, you know, batting down the hatches and really preparing yourself for the flood before it comes.
It's kind of daunting when you sit down and you're like, all right, I'm going to get my pears ready this year. And you're like, holy shit, there's 15 of them. So it's, you know, crap. And then you also do the math of the clutches that you have gotten from those girls or your mindset. You're looking at, you're standing on a barrel at like 200-something babies. And then you have somebody like... Nick Mutton walk around and go, I had 1,400 babies. It was a slow year for me. It's like, what? So,
well, it's interesting working for Eugene and sort of adopting that mindset of, like, instead of thinking in, like, onesie-twosies, now you're thinking in, like, dozens or hundreds almost. So, it's really interesting kind of adopting that mindset. And, you know, his two big philosophies are production and efficiency, and that's something that, you know, working for him, I've had beaten into my head until, you know, I can hardly think anything but production and efficiency. So it's all about numbers and managing numbers and preparing yourself to manage numbers and thinking ahead and what's the most efficient way to do what.
When you talk about efficiency, are you talking about, like, for lack of a better example, I'll think of, you know, if like Eugene, he's probably doing ball pythons. So as many genes as he can get into a male, he's going to get better results spreading that over a female. Is that what you're along the lines of what you're saying?
Not necessarily. I mean, sometimes that does play into effect, but it's a matter of what you're trying to produce. And I mean, this goes more into market talk than it does anything else, but, for him, the whole efficiency side of things is trying to get the most out of your effort.
Okay.
So the thing that him and I have both said in different ways, I've said is that I'm the hardest working, laziest person I know. So I don't mind working hard, but I want to do it the easiest way possible. So it's all about getting the maximum return for your effort. And for him, that's all about just setting up ways of doing things that really maximize your time. One of the things being, like, just the way we go about cleaning babies and stuff, it probably shaved 50 to 75% of the time that I was spending just learning to do it his way as compared to my way. So it's just a matter of getting the most effort out of your time.
any tips you could share with us for cleaning babies that helped you save time? Or is that top secret info?
Top secret info.
It's kind of hard to describe unless you're actually seeing it there, but basically we have them on, like, restaurant racks, and we can wheel them over to the sink, so that way you're not grabbing a tub, sliding it out, walking to the sink, and, you know, dumping the water. So it's all one motion. You
kill the second. Yeah, I got
you.
You kill the second that you would do.
It's like you pull out the stack, you open the lid, you dump the water, you clean the paper. While you're cleaning the paper, your other hand is refilling the water from the sink. So by the time you're done cleaning the cage, the water's also full. You snap the lid back on, and you've gone through. I mean, I can go through 80 babies in about 20 minutes. So it's very, very efficient.
Right. Huh. That's awesome. Very cool.
And then also that relates back to data and stuff as well, as far as how he keeps things. You know, instead of searching through, you know, mountains of paper or whatever, you have to set up in a way where you can just look at stuff and figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Huh. Cool.
Cool.
Are you anything else you wanted to hit on with carpets, Owen, or are you good there?
Can I have a question? Can you box up some girls? If you're female heavy, I'll take some off your hands to help you. But no, I think we're good. I'm more the best of luck to you with your collection. I know that the first couple of years can be a little scary.
Yeah, I mean,
just because you're putting all this stock into a girl, and hopefully it works out.
Yeah, last year was a really weird year for me because, I mean, I've been producing carpets pretty consistently every year. It's just this was the year where it's really going to snowball. But last year was a weird year because all of the females that had been breeding for me had, like, been breeding the past 3 years, so took the year off. Meanwhile, the virgin girls weren't big enough yet, so I just had this weird off year where the only carpet python clutch I got was the brettle, which, I mean, isn't really a carpet, but you know what I mean.
Right.
Gotcha.
Last year was a weird year, but this year should be more on track.
Cool.
It seems like everybody had a weird year last year, you know.
That seems to be the norm. The past 2 years have been funky for everybody. Something like girls breeding late, having clutches late, small numbers, a lot of ailments from what I've heard from a few people. So
I certainly haven't noticed smaller clutches or necessarily more illness, but late is definitely a big factor, especially last year we were kind of ready for it, but the year before that, everything was running about a month and a half to 2 months later than usual, especially down here in Florida. So basically all the breeders down here in one big collective mass were going through this panic of thinking no one was going to get any clutches over the course of the year. And eventually, you know, all the females kicked in, but it definitely threw us for a loop the first time it happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when I'm setting up hatch dates into September, and I'm like, this doesn't feel right to me. So, you know, it's one of those things.
Oh, yeah. All right, so another species that we wanted to talk about that you work with is chondros. What are you working with chondro-wise?
As far as chondros go, I really don't have too much. I think I have about, you know, half a dozen chondros or something like that. But I have some high yellow stuff, like some Bjork outcross stuff, some Aru, some just mainland. I have one mainland female that I think is going to go this year. And then the coolest green trees I think I have are the mustards, which I have a pair of solid yellow mustards. And those were recent pickups. And I bought that pair of adults and threw them together once, and that female ovulated like she was more than ready. So that'll be my first clutch of the year. And that's
cool.
From a female that I bought like 2 months ago. So go figure.
I dig this. They're really cool.
Yeah, I wish breeding snakes was always that easy, but no, the mustard females, or the mustards in general, that's just a cool looking green tree. It's, you know,
yeah.
I don't know if
you'd
call it 100% yellow, but it's more yellow than it is green, and they're certainly beautiful.
Yeah, that's cool. So, obviously, when we were talking about the whole temp regimen thing, you pretty much follow that, like you said, with all of your the pythons that you're breeding. Have you seen typical chondro problems, RIs, prolapses, sudden death, anything like that?
I haven't, but again, my sample size really isn't that big, so I haven't noticed any of those, but that could just be, you know, random occurrence. But actually, you talking about that did actually, you know, think of something in my mind. But when I first bred green trees, which was, like I said, I was like 16 or something like that, I didn't want to screw up the eggs, so I did maternal incubation on the for the female on the green trees. But I did not change any of the ambient temperatures. So I did maternal incubation with a flat temperature of 83 degrees. And this
wow.
is where it's really interesting. I had a temperature probe on the inside of the coils, and
uh-huh.
it did not drop below 88 degrees, which means that that green tree was generating heat well beyond the external temperature. There was nowhere in her cage for her to be exposed to 88-degree temperatures, so she was without a doubt generating that heat, which really goes to show that, you know, our
wow.
idea of exothermic and endothermic really aren't 100%. There's some kind of gray areas in between the two because, I mean, there's no doubt about it. She was generating heat. There's no other possible explanation. You can't just, you know, if you're only exposed to 83-degree temperatures, you can't magically be 88 degrees if, you know, 83 is the warmest you're exposed to.
Sure.
Unless
mm-hmm.
you're generating
wow.
your own heat.
That's crazy. That's pretty cool. Wow, you totally stumped me. I was going to ask you that question later, like as far as when the – have you done that with carpets at all too, with the flat
No, I haven't done any maternal incubation with carpets, but actually, I mean, thinking upon that same mindset, what's to say that they can only do that when they're, you know, brooding a clutch of eggs? You know, maybe if they're cold, they can warm themselves up. I mean, who knows? But, yeah,
Good
I
point.
Certainly thought that was interesting.
Huh. What
I
know
cool.
this is kind of off topic, too, but what are your thoughts on, like, I don't know if you've ever worked with them or if you've been exposed to them, but what about diamond pythons? Do you have any thoughts on those? Because typically, as far as carpet goes, they kind of fall into that, you know, with the brettles, you have to keep them a little bit on the cooler side, or they can't be exposed to high heat. Do you think that they fall into that same flat temp method?
I mean, I have one 75% diamond girl. I don't work with any pure diamonds. I never have. But I don't feel like they would fall into they would be an exception necessarily. I mean, I think they should fall into the same. Let me put it this way: I don't plan on doing anything differently for my 75% diamond girl.
Right.
I could see why you could justify keeping them differently, and I think physically they would be able to handle keeping it differently. But I don't know if that would necessarily change your production.
Okay. All right. So
but
back to the. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a shot in the dark. I have absolutely zero data to back me up on that one. So.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious on your thoughts because you know you're doing that with the species that you're working with. As far as back to chondros, what size? I'm just curious. What size when you bred the chondros? What size were they? Are you feeding them, keeping them big, or are you keeping them on the smaller side?
That's another good question because honestly, I mean, I can't even remember the last time I put a green tree on a scale. It's just a matter of, again, looking at them or being able to feel them and just feel if you think they're big enough to reproduce. And that goes across the board for just about any snake. I really don't go off of gram weight. But I do subscribe to the theory of not feeding a green tree python a rat. And I feed mine soft furs, which, you know, soft furs and mice I feel like are similar as far as their body fat composition. So I don't have any monster green tree pythons, that's for sure. They all probably fall under between 900 and 1,500 grams, somewhere in there.
Oh, wow. See, to me, that's a monster green tree python. See,
yeah.
I don't know, like...
no, again, I'm just completely guessing at this because I haven't put them on sale. I have no idea how much she actually would weigh, but certainly not more than 1,500 grams for the biggest one. And that's like a big Fiat girl, you know?
Sure. Yeah, I know. I mean, some people, yeah, they do. They keep them on the bigger side. It's just, I don't know, sometimes I think people's perceptions of what, when I first saw an adult green tree python, I was blown away by how small it actually was. I thought it was going to be huge, like a carpet python. I couldn't get over it. Like, I was like, really? That's an adult?
Absolutely. For me, it's not about a gram weight. It's about, like, the because I have some long chondros that are just lanky, you know? So it's about, do I think that they could develop and pass an egg inside of their body?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I don't know how you feel about this, but my experience with chondros is it's almost like, kind of like they have a body similar to like a walnut, to where it's almost like a triangle, rather than like a, you know, when, I think like when I first got into pythons, I thought everything looked like a Burmese python, so it was big, fat, and round, you know what I mean? And like, I'm noticing more and more that Morelia, especially, is not really geared that way. And
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a single green tree that looks round, or carpet really, for that matter, to some extent. I mean, carpets are a bit more round, but definitely not a green tree that looks round. And walnuts are very similar. I mean, muscle tone, if you actually held one or the other, they're very different. But for overall body shape, yeah, I'd say it's pretty similar.
Right. Cool. All right. Let's talk some blood pythons. That's your bread and butter, and you want to squeeze some of that talk in there and see about it. So, go ahead, Owen.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, the bloods are definitely my favorite, probably, out of the species I work with.
So what drew you to the blood python? I mean, it kind of seems like it's its own little special audience there, too.
Well, it's really the same thing that drew me to the carpets as well. I mean, they're bigger than a ball python. They're more more robust. They're more active. It's more of a dynamic snake. You can't just hand it to any 3-year-old and expect them to instantly be okay handling them. You know, it at least takes some conscious effort to really handle them. Not like they're mean per se, but you know what I'm saying. They're not just going to roll up in a ball and sit there.
They're
going to
be a python.
Yeah, absolutely. And bloods especially, they're bigger. They have a huge variety of colors, and they have a very good base to display that color on. You know, they have some size on them. It's not like a little corn snake where you're, like, squinting at it to see the pattern. You know, it's there.
So that's awesome. So what exactly are you working with when it comes to the bloods? I've seen some great-looking animals out there with the different types of blood.
Well, there are three different species of short-tailed pythons or blood pythons. I work like 99% with the red blood pythons, which are probably have the widest variety of color morphs. And I have a bunch of different projects on the reds. Probably some of my favorite have to be the petites, which, if you look at the petite blood pythons, both the heterozygous form and the super, it's literally the same mutation, I would say, as a zebra carpet python. Both supers are solid yellow with kink tails. Both heterozygous are really banded, busy pattern animals. I mean, I would bet money that if you bred a petite blood to a zebra carpet, you would get a yellow snake. It's virtually the same thing. And then the golden eyes are another just absolutely beautiful blood python. That's probably my favorite.
Awesome. So what are the other two types?
The other two types are the Sumatran short-tailed python, which most people call the black blood python, but whatever you call it, a black blood python, like half the people in the community just cry a little. It's like calling a diamond python a morph of carpet. yeah, it's just one of those taboos that you just don't do. And then the other species is the Borneo short-tailed python, and I have one pair of those, but they don't do it for me as much as the reds or the blacks.
Okay, so what other types of morphs or bloods are you excited about?
Well, I mean, the T-positive stuff is probably the most common, and that's what most people think when they see an albino blood. But really what I've been pushing is the T-negative albinos, which are the true albinos. And those, they start out kind of yellowy orange and white. They kind of do the opposite of what the carpet pythons do. They start out like a yellowy white, and then as they get older, they just build and build and build and build in color until you get like this, like, fire engine red animal in contrast with this stark white. It's probably one of the most striking blood python mutations out there. I could not think of a better snake to have an albino in than, like, you know, classic fire engine red blood python. There's just nothing more impressive.
Awesome.
I've never seen red that even parallels that on an albino, a T-negative albino blood python.
Cool. So, like, how many bloods are currently in the collection?
I have no idea. I probably have a couple dozen. No, more than that. More than that. I probably have well over 100 at this point.
Wow, that's insane. So, what are your thoughts on some of the myths that are associated with the bloods? Because, from what I've heard, is that they are little psychotic. It's a Gaboon viper without the venom. So,
both bloods and carpets both suffer from that misconception of being mean snakes. Mm. Probably blood pythons more so, because when you think about it, the number of adult imported blood pythons is way, way, way more than the number of adult imported carpet pythons. But if you get a wild-caught carpet python, especially one that's like, well, the blood pythons, most of the imported adults all came from the skin trade. And they really weren't treated very nice, and they would bite the ever-living crap out of you for, you know, a good amount of time. But I have wild-caught adult bloods in my collection that tame down after about 6 months or so. So it's really, if you're importing any adult animal, especially from the skin trade, yeah, they're going to bite the crap out of you. And so that's where most of those really stemmed from, because for the first, you know, when they were first available, that was the only ones you could get were adult imported animals. So and carpets kind of have that same reputation of being bitey. And, you know, carpets, for the first year, they might bite the ever-living crap out of you. But once they hit about a year old and they realize you're not going to eat them or skin them alive, they really calm right down.
Awesome. At least that's the common misconception that kind of goes between both species. So, the other one I've heard is that they need, like, almost swamp humidity-wise. They need, like, a lot of humidity.
Now, this is something that I think Terry Phillips was spot on the nose when he said this, and that I don't even own a hydrometer. Humidity is completely irrelevant toward snake husbandry for the most part.
Okay.
Now, what I do, and I do this for almost every species of python at this point that I have, when I notice that they're opaque and right before they shed out, I pretty much soak them in water. So they're actually sitting on damp paper or, in the blood's case, actually sitting in a little bit of water. And for some reason, even though that they're not, it's not like soaking them. They're not like physically underwater like you would use to get suck shed off. But for some reason, just sitting in a little bit of water, they kind of like, it just hydrates them and they shed perfectly. But other than that, I don't even own a hydrometer. They get normal sized water bowls, just like a ball python or anything else. It's nothing special.
Okay. And they don't have, I've heard also issues with them having to defecate. No issues there?
It's not an issue. You just have to expect it. I mean, that's the beauty of it. They only go to the bathroom once every 3 months. So, you know, sit back and enjoy it. You're not having to clean the tub every
Awesome.
Yeah, it's a good thing. I don't know why people get so worked up over it. But the problem with blood pythons is that people aren't used to their metabolisms. My adult bloods at 25 pounds eat less than my adult ball pythons because their metabolism is just so slow. People see a blood python and they think because it's, you know, has some girth to it, they want to feed it a rabbit or, you know, two jumbo rats a week. And then you just get these massively fat blood pythons that just don't want to breed for you. Even though they have some size to them, you can't feed them like a Burma or a retic or anything like that. you just won't get production out of them. Their metabolism is not made for that. It's made to sit in one spot for months and months at a time. Any a rat, maybe if it walks by every month or two, and then not have to move and not go to the bathroom for 3 months, you know. So they're very efficient snakes. They make use of every calorie you give them. So that's probably the most common mistake I see is people overfeeding blood pythons.
Wow. So what you're saying is that I should change my entire collection over to bloods.
I'm saying that in terms of babies produced per meal, the bloods probably take the cake. Because I'll get 20 to 24 eggs off of the same meals that I'm getting 8 eggs from a ball python. So that's, I mean, that speaks for itself.
Yeah, it does. Wow. There might be something to these little buggers. So, so your approach to keeping the blood pythons as opposed to your approach to keeping your carp pythons, is it different at all?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't feed them as much. That's
the only difference?
Yeah, that's the only difference. I mean, the cages are the same, and like you said, the only thing I do is really make them or let them sit in water when they're about to shed. But beyond that, they're very, very similar.
Wow. All right. So have you noticed any increased interest with the bloods as you've seen the increased interest in other species of python?
Oh, absolutely, especially as more of the morphs become commonplace. A lot of people like to really complain about dropping prices. And, yeah, dropping prices do suck to some extent, but a lot of people assume that, you know, if the price drops by 10%, then your market only expands 10%. But what they don't realize is that when the price drops 10%, your market might double. It's not, you know, linearly linked. So as some of these morphs are dropping down in prices and more people are being exposed to them, the demand is just shot through the roof, especially with blood pythons. And a lot of that is fueled by because it's something that has morphs that's not a ball python. So people are getting a little bit tired of seeing only ball pythons, and that's really kind of added interest into other species that have the morphs that aren't ball pythons, you know?
Do I understand that?
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, let's face it, at this point, a lot of us are pretty morph-obsessed. So that's, when you look at pythons as a whole, you got the monster that is ball pythons. But if you take a step further than that, what other species do you know of that actually have a decent palette of morphs, and you basically are left with carpets and bloods?
Unless you want to go into retics and berms and stuff.
Yeah, unless you want to really get into the big stuff. But, you know, certainly people's situations a lot of times don't allow for that. So,
true.
Do you find that the person that's getting into the blood python is more the person that is, you know, they want that huge snake, but they can't take care of it adequately. So blood pythons sort of fill that void because they're pretty impressive. I mean, adult blood python is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it looks bigger than what it is.
They look a lot bigger than they actually are. I mean, my biggest female is like 20, 24 pounds, and maybe I think I measured her, and she was a little over 5 foot. So they really don't get that big on paper, but when you see it in person, it is an impressive-looking snake. So
right.
I think that's certainly a large chunk of the market. And then the other stuff, you have both ends of the spectrum. You have bigger people trying to downsize, and you have smaller people trying to upsize, and that's sort of like the perfect middle animal.
Right. And that's kind of like where carpets and bloods are very similar because, you know, if you're into like, it seems to me, I don't know, there's fat snake people that like fat snakes and people that like a more slender type of snakes. And usually the two don't kind of intersect. So it seems like the people that are into like maybe ball pythons or like the big snakes, go towards the, you know, the Bloods to get that niche, you know, that they like, that they can keep it, but not have to maintain a, you know, a 10-foot cage or something like that. I mean, what size cages are you keeping your Bloods in?
I use the ARS, I think they're 8018s, whatever they are. They're 3 CB70s is the same floor space as 2 of these tubs, so
okay.
It's basically a CB70 and a half. I use the same for carpets and Bloods.
Okay. Very cool. My other question, just going back as far as blood pythons go with some of the myths that surround them, what about shedding issues and respiratory infections? Is that something that you encounter frequently, or is that, you know, not true?
Well, like I said, with shedding issues, especially if you let them sit in a little bit of water, that really helps. But even when they do have a bad shed, even if you completely missed it, and the thing is, like, if you completely missed the shed altogether and you come in and the thing's just, like, big chunks of shed skin sticking off it, if you even then just soak it down, then you continue to shed out perfectly. So I've never really had problems with them shedding. But respiratory infections certainly can be an issue in the blood pythons. And, you know, that's just comes with some of the territory of some of these species. And a lot of times I think the problem there is if you're keeping them, you know, a little bit too hot. I mean, it's usually a husbandry issue, but too hot
right.
sometimes comes into play. But the other thing that really comes into play with Bloods is if you have a snake that has a respiratory infection, I like to give them a little bit more space to spread out and really get a chance to kind of work that mucus out. Because when they're crammed in a little bitty tub, I mean, for the most part, Bloods don't move very much at all, but I will make an exception and give them a bigger cage when they have a respiratory just to give them a chance to really work that mucus out. But that's the only detractor from blood pythons that I've bumped into is that respiratory infections are not completely uncommon.
Okay. All right. I heard one time before that people that keep large snakes, especially like you take Burmese, and that they would have respiratory infections a lot of time. And sometimes that was just like you were saying, they were kept in a smaller type of enclosure and they can't really spread out. Their lung is kind of like not able to, spread out all the way. So they kind of cramped up, which leads to problems. And you think that that's similar with the Bloods? Do you think that they have?
Yeah, that's actually room? hearing some of that information is what triggered me to start treating it in that way. And
okay.
It works out pretty well. And then the other time, you get the occasional animal that's just really weird, and like every time they go into shed, they just decide to have a respiratory, and then as soon as they shed out, it goes away. So they're just odd snakes sometimes, but I certainly don't consider it like a like a big deal.
Right. Okay. Interesting. And as far as you said, there's 3 species, right? They're not subspecies.
Yeah.
They're 3 separate species. So do you have – I don't really know this that well, but is it similar to like in the carpet world? Do they cross those, or is that like – somebody's going to take you out and
that hybridization,
stone
yeah.
you to death, or, you know,
yeah, they're,
what's
the
norm there?
Because they are full species, and they were at one time considered subspecies, and at one time we had no idea what python was coming into the country. We just called them all Python Curtis. So as time has gone by, it's become increasingly more negative as we've further separated out the 3 species. So at this point, hybrids are very negatively perceived. That being said, there are some produced. I actually do have a pair of hybrids. I have a pair of T-negative albinos crossed to the black Bloods, so the black, you know, short-tail pythons, the Sumatran short-tail pythons. So it's sort of like a T-negative that instead of being red and white is yellow and white. It's very different looking, very cool looking, but when I first hatched out, it was pretty much all white, so I called it the abominationable snowman. Yeah, to screw with people a little bit. Because, I mean, people take everything just so personally nowadays. And at the end of the day, we all forget that we're keeping more snakes in a plastic box in a snake room thousands of miles away from Indonesia. And you really, you got to enjoy it. And so I have this pair of snakes, and I think they're the coolest things ever. And I really, they're not part of my business. I really don't plan on pushing those. But I think they're really cool, and so I enjoy working with them. But, you know, some people get mad as hell that I have that pair of snakes. But, you know, you just kind of have to get over yourself and have fun with it.
Right.
Right.
Sorry, Owen, awesome. I kind of jumped in there. I don't know if...
It's okay. Go ahead and do that.
I know.
Yeah,
blood,
I mean,
like, go ahead.
I have plenty of pure stuff. I love the pure stuff. And like I said, I really don't plan on building up my hybrid collection. But, you know, the hybrids are very negatively perceived, at least in the majority of circles.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, I'm curious to what your thoughts are on, is it similar to like what we're seeing in scrub pythons, where there could be other species of blood pythons or short tail pythons, other than the three that are named?
Kind of. I mean, certainly there are three that are the most prevalent in captivity. I think there was a fourth species described. I have to go back and find the paper, but basically there's one picture of it, and I can't find any other information supporting that or denying it. The picture certainly does look a little bit different than the other three, but at this point they are considered, for all practical purposes, three species, and like I said, the fourth one was described. But I wouldn't be surprised if the red blood pythons were split up into two groups, because basically you have red blood pythons on Sumatra, and across on the other side of the island, across from the mountain range, are the black short-tail pythons, which are, again, on the same island of Sumatra. So the two species on Sumatra are considered different species, yet the red blood python on Sumatra and the red blood python on Malaysia are considered the same species. So, you know, I think I think the ones in Malaysia versus the ones in Sumatra we're going to find are sufficiently different enough to consider themselves at least subspecies, if not full species. But until then, they are considered the same species, even though they're on two different islands, whereas the two species that are on the same island are considered two species. So it's sort of just a weird little, I don't know, if you're into weird geography and looking how the species are laid out. I think taxonomy-wise, we're going to see a change there in the next couple of years. But until then, there are three, possibly four species. But like I said, for all practical purposes, three as far as we're concerned.
All right. I guess this kind of ties into the whole, we're going to talk a little bit about the python market and the reptile market. And working with Eugene and being in Florida, you kind of have a good pulse, I would think, on the whole market. So I guess I don't know if you hit on this question, Owen, but do you see an increased interest in bloods? Did you hit on that?
Yeah, I did say
Okay. So, all right, with that being said, what's your thoughts on the ball python market, and how does it compare to other more niche python markets?
Well, people love giving the ball python market a hard time. And, you know, they certainly bring up valid points, but, you know, you can't think of things in black and white, good and evil and all that stuff. The ball python market certainly has its place, and, you know, people can complain all they want about it crashing, but there's still people out there who make decent money breeding ball pythons. So the money's definitely there. It's just a matter of finding where that money is. And people are finding out that maybe the market or the money isn't in the $10,000 snake, because, you know, it's at that point they're kind of like Pokemon cards, and people just sort of trade them in between each other. No one actually will throw out that big chunk of change unless it's something really special. But it certainly does have its place, and you certainly can make money doing ball pythons. You have to be smart about it. And with some of the niche stuff, it's a bit more forgiving. I mean, you still have to plan out your projects, but there's not as much flood of different stuff, so you have a bit more leeway as far as picking your projects.
Okay. All right. So, so that being said, what are your thoughts on if you want to be a full-time breeder? But what do you think that has to come into play as far as what you want to do as opposed to, you know, what people want?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the full-time breeder question, I go back and forth with this.
Do we all? So do we all.
Yeah, I mean, certainly at this point, I feel it's well within my abilities to be a full-time breeder. It's just a matter of the more time I spend in the industry and in the community, it's just a matter of do I want to be doing this for the rest of my life? And maybe that's too strict of a viewpoint to have it, but it's like I've been doing this since I was, like I said, I was 13 when I sold my Legos and started breeding snakes. So I've been doing this for the majority of my life almost, and you know, I kind of want to play around with some stuff that I don't like just to reaffirm that this is what I want to do with my life, you know?
Right. Okay. So
what was your second question?
Well, I guess this kind of plays in. Is it important to have, you know, like a rounded collection, diverse portfolio, if you will, of what you have to offer as a breeder? I mean, I think that's kind of the thing that, me personally, that I struggle with. It's that, you know, coming from business, you're running a business that's not the reptile market, I don't per se sell what I like. I get what my customer likes.
Right.
And yeah, when it comes to reptiles, I keep what I like because that's what I like, and that is more of my hobby. Then I think about, you know, if I wanted to do this and have it pay for my hobby, do I then bring in another species that's more mainstream that kind of fits into what I'm doing, but we'll be able to sell at a reptile show, so to speak?
Well, I mean, I think that there's several different aspects to it. My philosophy has always been, if I like it and if I'm willing to pay money for it, chances are some idiot out there is probably willing to do it the same. So, so yeah, I've been known to kind of like buy weird things and just sort of on the off chance that someone else out there likes it too. But so that's been my philosophy. But the real question is, it just comes down to a matter of price. You know, just because I think a snake's worth, you know, X number of dollars when I get around to producing it, doesn't mean other people will too. But it's just a matter of picking your projects well. Whether you want to diversify or not is really up to you. I've seen great businesses built off of diversification, and I've seen great businesses built off of, you know, your monocultural type snake production. So,
and what do you think separates the two? Like, what did you see in those guys that just had the, you know, just, you know, one species that they're working with?
Well, I mean,
them apart.
Especially when we're talking ball pythons, I know it's hard to imagine, but there are actually people out there who aren't money hungry ball python breeders who genuinely love ball pythons. So,
no.
Yeah, I know it's weird, but so the people that are passionate about ball pythons really love ball pythons, and that's what they desire to keep. But a lot of people have, you know, 80% ball pythons and then 20% other stuff that they like to dabble in. But it's really, it comes down to marketing yourself. And do you want to market yourself as, you know, for certain projects, for certain species, for certain types of snakes? Like, do you want to, you can really go as broad or as narrow as you can really afford to go. It's just a matter of, will the market support you, you know? That being said, I don't think you can do everything and still be as successful. You just there's simply no way to have that mental energy to do, you know, across the boards, colubrids and pythons and boas and you name it. You know, you at a certain point, it just becomes too much.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how people like, you know, like you, I guess you have to hire people and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that to me is like, I don't know, that's too big for me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It certainly can be. So it's just a matter of really marketing yourself and marketing the projects you invest in. And I think that can be as wide or as narrow as you choose it to be. It's all about, people always talk about the market as if it's this magical thing that is somehow untouchable. But what you do really does shape the market, and I don't think people realize it as much as they do, or as much that it holds true, that what you do will shape the market. Even this littlest thing, like someone posting a snake on a forum, can actually completely alter a market.
Yeah,
absolutely. So it really comes down to, you know, how you present yourself as, you know, we've talked about this before on the show, but I think that people, they often make the mistake that they go and you want to call them keyboard cowboys or, you know, whatever. But, you know, they make the mistake that they're putting stuff on a Facebook or on a forum, and people are reading it and they're thinking, man, this guy's an asshole. I'm not going to buy a snake from him. You know, I've done it. I'm sure you guys have done it, right? If you come across a post and you're like, man, that guy's an idiot. Even if he has the snake you want, you know, you're still going to be like, nope, never mind, nothing from him. You know, that all kind of factors into that, you know. That being said, just curious, what do you think of the carpet or blood python market? Like, where do you see that going in the future? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, this is where carpets and buds kind of diverge a little bit, because when you look at most of the cutting-edge stuff, and no discredit to American breeders, but most of the cutting-edge carpet stuff is coming out of Europe somewhere, but most of the cutting-edge blood stuff is happening over here. So in terms of attracting international attention, if I'm from, you know, Japan, and if I'm looking to buy, because these people are looking to buy other weird stuff that aren't necessarily ball pythons, if I'm looking to buy cutting-edge carpet pythons, I'm going to go to Germany, whereas if I'm looking to buy cutting-edge ball pythons, you know, I'd probably stay in the U.S. So I think a lot of times getting that international revenue in really sets the foundation for some of the lower-end animals as well. And when you see some of those higher-end animals start selling for big money, that's when you know the lower-end stuff's really about to take off too. So I think that both the carpets and the blood market are very strong and going to grow. I think they're powder kegs because people are looking for stuff that's not a ball python that has the morphs, and carpets and blood pythons really do fill that niche. It's just a matter of, you know, getting the right animals into the right people's hands.
Right, right.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know. I've seen there was a thread that was over on MP, but I think it got deleted, and it was the last day. I don't know if that was the thread that sent it over the edge, but I can't remember who was the person that posted it. I think it might have been Shay Peterson, but he was just kind of like not slamming the carpet market, but saying that it's not what we think. You know, I kind of have mixed feelings on that. I kind of think that, you know, I'm a person that I would rather, I think that $200 to $500 is the perfect price. Maybe $500, maybe to $1,000. You know, because you're dealing with something that's not too expensive, but you're still you know, making decent money. I think, it, like you said earlier, it opens up that market to more people. You know, I'd be curious to see what happens with Jags this year.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're not talking, like, most of the good money is made between $100 and $500.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can sell a $5,000 snake, but it's a heck of a lot easier to sell 10 $500 snakes. So.
Yep.
So that's where the power of the market lies, not in some of the higher-end stuff. And that's kind of why a lot of times the snake market acts as like a pyramid scheme, and that everyone's so focused on the top of the pyramid. Meanwhile, they're being fed animals from the base of the pyramid trying to reach that top of the pyramid, while the top of the pyramid is always changing. So it's, people
yeah.
get really discouraged when they feel like they're running on this treadmill, you know, kind of thing. But if you can make, you know, 100 to 500 bucks a snake, that is, I think that's a strong market, especially if you can do it in volume.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, I see this, to me, I kind of look at, like, the show. I kind of look at, you know, when we have certain guests on, and I can see those, how many people are listening and whatnot. And, you know, to me, whether there's people out there, I realize that there's people that are not keeping carpets that would listen to the show. But at the same time, you know, when you have, you know, that large number of people listening to the show, and, you know, you're having breeders come on and talk up the species that they're working with. To me, even if you capture 10% of those people, to me, that's growth. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but when my business is up 10%, that's pretty damn good, you know?
That's a good friggin' day, yeah.
Yeah, you know. I mean, I'm talking about our day jobs, you know. Oh, and if you were up 10% in sales, you would be pretty happy, right? I know.
I want to be up 10% in sales, for the love of God.
Yeah,
I need to be up 10% in sales. I need a house. So.
So, I don't know. Any other thoughts you had on the market, or, you know, what do you think? Or I know you said something
well,
before the show. Go ahead.
I think that, I mean, the best principle I've heard is just to stay strong and hold the course. I mean, you know, you're into sales, so you know what it's like. You have to say something dozens and dozens of times before it starts sinking into other people's heads that, you know, you might be onto something. So, you know, I'm screaming blood pythons until I'm red in the face, but it's starting to pay off a little bit. So it's all just a matter of working the project and marketing it and not getting frustrated when, you know, you think it's the coolest snake in the world, but maybe the other people don't. But, you know, sooner or later, someone else is going to see it who thinks it's cool, and then they start saying it's cool, and then it becomes cool. You know, it's
yeah.
all just a matter of the, you know, you can look at it in a social context of, you know, the early adopters, and then the, you know, it's just like any other trend. So it's all about marketing, whether you want to look at it as harsh and cold marketing or what's cool, you know.
Yeah, it's funny how, like, that. That's so true that people just react to what – I say that all the time, that people should just kind of, you know, I say passion, but whatever, however you want to put it, you know, if you just preach about what you're doing, people will follow you, man. It may take a while, and you have to have patience, and you have to be consistent, but I think ultimately – if you stick with, like you're saying, you stick with your projects. I see that a lot. People, man, people bail
mm-hmm.
out, you know?
Yep. You don't have success after 2 years, so you sell the project.
Hey, man, I'm just going to throw this one out there. You know, hey, you know, people bust the ball pythons all the time, but I think more people bail on scrub pythons than they do on ball pythons. You know what I mean?
True.
Like. It's like, oh, man, these aren't breeding. I'm getting rid of them. I think the same thing
happens.
They're
mean and they're not breeding, yeah.
Yeah, the same thing happens with blackheads. You know, Derek Grotty's talked about it thousands of times about how all of a sudden you'll see on Kingsnake and there'll be all these blackheads up for sale. And
it's because that wave thing happens where somebody puts up a pair of blackheads for like $4,000 and then all of a sudden the ad goes away. So you don't know whether that person pulled that ad or sold it or whatever, but the second that ad goes away, all of a sudden, everybody who's got a pair of blackheads that isn't doing anything for them throws them up on Kingsnake for some ridiculous amount of money. And then all those pairs, all those people throw those pairs up, those numbers start dropping and going all over the place. And then you end up, you know, selling a pair of perfectly fine blackheads for like $600. So,
right.
And then you get that whole wave and then they all go away. And then you don't see blackheads on Kingsnake for a very long time. And then they all flood back on again when somebody else does the same thing. The same thing happens with water pythons, ring pythons, any little niche kind of a thing. It just all of a sudden, it just everything shows up and they all go away. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on, Steve, on some of the rarer type of species? Is that, you know, I hear a lot of times that you know, that seems like the consensus is of late that people are more, it's like the morph is a bad word. Do you see the same thing or what's your thoughts?
I would probably disagree with that for the most part. I mean, the heavy hitters are always going to be stuffed with morphs. That's just, it's at this point part of the herp culture. So I don't think you're ever going to beat the morph out of herpiculture at this point. But that being said, there certainly is a demand for some of these other species that maybe don't have morphs in them. But it's never going to be as mainstream as, like, ball pythons or even carpets and bloods because they simply just, the morphs aren't there, you know?
Yeah.
I agree.
I think
it's
the thing
fun
you
to have
see.
These rare stuff.
I think the thing you see, though, is like you can take ring pythons, you can take white lips pythons. You know, I think that the person that's breeding them and, you know, they put in the work, they haven't given up on the project, that, you know, because they dig them, you know. But you've seen people go in and out of them, they have them, they get rid of them, they have them, they want them back, they, you know, it's because somebody has them and they want to get into it again. But, you know, with that type of market, I think why that person is so successful is because when you only have one clutch of ring pythons a year, you're talking, what, 12, 15 sales?
Absolutely, yeah. It all relates back to supply and demand, you know, and there definitely is demand. It's not necessarily through the roof in the tens of thousands like there are in some of these other species, but if the supply is not that great either, then, you know,
who else are you going to go to?
There certainly can't be money there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't, you know, you think about, like, again, I use ring pythons as an example, but you don't see, like, anybody really. I can think of one person that, like, actually two people. You know, there's Chris at Mystics Exotics, and then there's Tom Keogan. But the only two people that I know that work with ring pythons and that are actually trying to say that they're cool or talk about them or put them up on a forum or anything like that.
Yeah.
Other than that,
I don't
do
mine back.
It's funny. Both those guys are both friends of mine. But, yeah, they're working the ring pythons pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're cool animals.
Well, I guess my thing is that, obviously, I've never dealt with them, but I've heard that you know, breeding them is a little difficult. You know, the female eat the male, and they're not – they're a little – they can be a little bit on the aggressive side, and, you know, but come on, man. It's – I don't know. That's a cool python, but
– it's something different. It's something cool. It's something that'll – and the baby ring python, I can stick a baby ring python in a display across the room, and people are going to gravitate towards it. Because it's something cool, something different, and they just are amazing looking. So,
right.
I would love it if everybody who has
the mainstream animals or the bread and butters could get one pair of something funky, just cause it'd be cool. Cause I would hate to have these animals lost to the industry or to the hobby just because they don't have a morph.
Right.
You know, I love my Lyasis, and that was Eric's damn fault. So the second that happened, I'm like, I would never have even thought about chancing into the Lyasis unless I had fallen into it by accident. And, you know, the Leopythons, I'm all about them too. And
right.
It's something different. It's something cool. It's almost like it's a challenge. It's,
right.
You know, they don't breed as easy.
But do you think that that's the hobby side of you or the business side of you? You know what I'm saying?
That's the hobby side of me. The business side of me would smack me. These are big cages that I can put big animals in that are going to consistently produce. I should have goddamn red tails in these cages that are going to just pop out a bunch of freaking normal red babies that I can sell for $10 a piece. That's the business side of me. But instead, I got it filled with a bunch of pissed off, angry white lips who, one pair, they don't even like each other. So, you know, it makes no sense. But it's making it enjoyable for me, and that's the whole point. If you don't have fun with it, why the hell are you doing it?
Right. Yeah, certainly those niche species feed into the hobbyist side more so than the business side. And you can absolutely make money breeding those guys, don't get me wrong. But, yeah, that
right.
The desire to own, they're one of those things that they're just cool in and of themselves, you know. There's some things that are expensive because they're cool, and there's some things that are cool because they're expensive. And those fall into the category of they're just cool, you know.
Right. And I mean, the customer basis is you don't get the guy that's like, oh, my God, I've needed this for my breeding program. I have 8 females ready to go. No, you get the guy that is like, holy crap, I love these things. Ever since I saw one years ago, I got to get a pair. So, yeah.
the last thing that I wanted to ask you about the market is just your, because you work with ball pythons, right?
Not a whole lot. But through Eugene, yeah, I probably work with quite a few.
Okay. So what about, you know, the one thing that kind of that really irks me, I guess, really gets me going is this kind of like negative vibe that it's almost like if you're into this python, for some reason you can't like another python. And if you do, you just badmouth, you know, that other group. So, for instance, you're in the blood pythons. You don't go around bad-mouthing, you know, somebody that breeds olive pythons. You really dig blood pythons, and you talk about blood pythons. Why do you think, and do you think we'll ever get away from the whole negativity? How can we change that? And do you notice it, or is it just me?
I noticed that. I think it's a lot of hot smoke, to be honest. I think a lot of people like to complain about that because it's something fun to complain about. when you actually look back and see how it reflects into the numbers and how it reflects into the market and sales and stuff like that, it really has, I think, very little relevance. So, oh, this guy has some ball pythons, so he's stupid and he's not going to buy, I'm not going to sell snakes to him, or I'm not going to buy snakes from him. You know, it's, in all practical purposes, it really doesn't play out like that. It's just, let's be honest, it's just fun to complain about stuff sometimes, you know?
Yeah,
it is. It's fun to jab at people.
But...
Okay. All right.
Cool.
All right. Go for it, Owen.
Oh, yes. All right. So now we get to the fun part of the show, which is the final couple questions that make you think here, Steve. So here you go. If you could have any species or subspecies of python, what would it be? Now, money and law is no object. Go.
I had to do some thinking about this because I knew it was coming right out. I did get the chance to play around with some adult carinata. Those were pretty cool, not going to lie. So that's definitely up there on the list. Those were a lot of fun. And I just like weird, unique stuff like that. But
okay.
Honestly, to me, if I could narrow it down to, you know, one snake, it's really hard to beat a blood python. They really do it for me.
All right, so just more blood python. Okay. All right. So if you could work with any non-Morelia reptile in the world, what would it be?
I've had daydreams for a long time of getting a baby Aldabran tortoise and watching it grow up. I used to volunteer for a very famous turtle biologist. I don't know if you guys know of him, but he's Dr. Peter Pritchard. He happened to live in my hometown, but
that's awesome.
He went to the Seychelles when he was, I don't even know how old he was, but it was years ago, way before CITES or anything was enacted.
Mm-hmm.
He brought back a baby Aldabran tortoise in his suitcase on a plane. He had it for years and years, and it grew up into this 200-pound monster. Her name was Bernice. So ever since working with that animal, that has always been stuck in the back of my head. That's something I need to get one day.
It's funny that you mentioned that because they were actually somebody threw up some Aldabra, or actually I think it was Galapagos tortoise on the rare reptile form, and people were like, oh, my God. And I think there are also some Aldabras up there, too. I know you have to get a permit, but it's not too far-fetched, do I get them?
No, he had some Aldabrans and some big Galapagos tortoises, and they were a lot of fun. And the Aldabran actually bit my finger one time and wouldn't let go for 5 minutes, but that was a lot of fun. But there's just something about big tortoises like that.
I was assaulted by a tortoise. I didn't see him coming. What?
Well, like,
oh, yeah.
If you know anything about tortoises, like, so it bit me, and then I yelled, and it freaked out, so it pulled its head in its shell with my arm still in its mouth. So put its hands inside of the shell, and then, you know them, whenever they bite something that they can't break off, they start scraping it with their big claws, and I mean, when you're talking about a giant tortoise, they're big claws. So
Jesus.
My hand's stuck inside of this tortoise's shell, and she's just raking up my arms, and I could not get her to let go. And it was like 5 minutes until someone finally came and helped me pry her mouth open so I could get my finger out. But I love
her. God, that sounds horrible. all right, no more petting tortoises. All right. But that is cool. I would do that as well. So if you could work with one species of python, what would it be?
Like I said, it's probably got to be the bloods. They're just
stick with the bloods.
Yeah, if I could only pick one, it would probably be the bloods. There's just something about them where it's like this is a python. There is no if, and, or but.
That is, I can definitely dig it, and I'm gonna have to. I've been seriously looking into getting a pair of bloods just to tinker with, so this is a terrible decision having you on the show now. So
what other python is red like a blood python, you know? And they keep getting redder, you know, as they get older.
Yeah.
They're cool.
Right.
Damn.
I do have I wanted to hit on this real quick before you jump off. In case anybody doesn't know, Steve used to do a podcast called Reptile Talk, and I don't know if you want to give people the update of where you're at with that. And I know you also didn't you also do a lot of YouTube videos and such.
Yeah,
you know, throw that info out there so that you know, people can check you out and whatnot.
Yeah, the podcast actually stemmed from the YouTube. So YouTube, I was doing YouTube for years now. Basically, when I started out, I had like 4 snakes. So it's really interesting if you go back and watch. You can literally watch me build my business up over the course of 5 or 6 years to where it's at today. So my YouTube channel is just Reptiles Herps, if you just type that in. But basically, because I'm young, when I started the channel, I was like 14, and now I'm, you know, 19. So I'm still pretty young, but I built a pretty large following of younger herpers who are, you know, just getting into it. And so the Reptile Talk really started as a way to really hit that target audience to try to reach out to them as far as some of the things that I would see. And I teamed up with a friend of mine named Jeremy, who's, again, Jeremy Turgan, who's my age. I think he's a little bit older, actually. But, again, we're both kind of spokesmen in some respects towards the younger audience. So we really wanted to kind of address them as far as some of the stuff we were seeing, like, you know, having 3 corn snakes does not mean you need to make a business Facebook page and or a website or anything like that. Like, people were just getting too antsy and jumping the gun, and when you jump the gun, it can actually be detrimental if you want to, you know, continue on to this, because you lose a lot of respect when you call yourself a business, yet, you know, you have 3 snakes. It's just not necessary.
Right.
So we really wanted, that was the main goal, and then eventually it turned into, you know, a traditional interview-type podcast where we had some breeders and stuff on, but eventually we accomplished our main goal, I think, of trying to say what we need to say, and then beyond that, it just became an issue of time management, so...
Okay.
But I'm still doing the YouTube thing. The YouTube thing is really cool as far as the audience you gain. But it's a double-edged sword because you gain a lot more than just reptile people. You have other people from all aspects of life who accidentally stumble upon videos. So you have to be really careful about the stuff that you post out.
Right.
Which is where I disagree about some other people who may post some stuff. But... you really want to put your best foot forward in that aspect. So.
Sure. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So.
What's your YouTube page?
It's Reptilis Herbs.
Reptilis Herbs. Okay. Very cool.
Which is my website as well.
Okay. Yeah. I just put a link up on the Morelia Python Radio Facebook page of your website, reptilisherbs.com, so if people want to check it out. And there will be a link over on moreliapythonradio.com, too, so you can go from either spot. Anything else that you want to put out there besides blood pythons are awesome? anything else?
I think that really hit the gamut.
All right, man. Thanks for coming on the show. You know,
definitely.
Hopefully, you're always welcome back. So, you know, when you hit your big breeding season this year, you definitely are the type of person, I really like having these type of guests, like you, Steve, because I'll tell you why, because you're into what you're doing. You don't give a shit what anybody else thinks because you think it's cool. And the thing of it is that, when you think it's cool, people turn around and they think it's cool. And I think that, you know, whereas blood pythons might not be for everybody, not to take away from anything else that you keep, but I don't know. I just see you and I associate you with blood pythons. So I guess your marketing is working.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, but, you know, I just think that you do it in a positive way, man. And I think that's awesome. I'm going to give you props for that, and you're the type of breeders that that this industry, hobby, whatever you want to call it, needs, you know? Kudos to you.
I really appreciate that, and I appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah,
definitely. Absolutely.
So, all right, man, have a good night, and we'll talk again.
You too. Take care.
Okay, right. Bye, Steve.
Bye.
Awesome stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I'm not going to I don't know who – I have a guest lined up, I think, for next week, but I have to wait to hear if they're going to do it. So I'm not going to announce that yet.
Right. All I'm going to do is stand by just in case we call you at, like, you know, 8:50 on Tuesday. You were going to be on.
Yeah. So
yeah.
For the month of November, what we have lined up is we have November 5th, that's still open. Casper, our good buddy Casper from Singular Reptiles, is coming back on on the 12th. We're going to follow that up with the results show. So make sure you dust off your tux, Owen. And
I am already wearing it. I mean, I'm sorry, I got too excited. Sorry, I'll put it away.
We're going to be joined by Julie. GFX Morelia, and we're going to be announcing.
If you win, you get two. Because if you win, one of the prizes is you get to judge next year.
Yes.
So not only do you get a cool snake, you get to come and hang out with us next year.
Yeah. So now that MP is back up, you can post your picks over there, or you can post your picks
on Facebook.
On Facebook, Morelia Python Radio page. Either one. Doesn't make a difference, but just
now
sure
you really have no excuse. Yeah,
exactly. after that, we have round table number four, right into the holiday, Thanksgiving week. We're going to be doing round table number four, and that's going to be primarily focused with carpets. And we may have a special guest joining us for that roundtable, but I just have to make sure that they're in the game, and we should be good to go. So that's always fun, you know, discussing various topics and what we think and all that kind of stuff. So, so that's the month of November, trying to think if there's anything else we need to hit on. Just make sure you go over now that, don't forget, MP, Morelia Pythons, is back up. It's a little, like we said, it's going through some cosmetic changes, but it's definitely good that they only lost 1 week's worth of information rather than a neck.
It's a whole year.
Yeah. So,
awesome.
Good stuff. So yeah, go over there. If you're not already a member, sign up, become a member over there. You can pretty much encompass everything that we do over on MoreliaPythonRadio.com. Go over there, check it out. If you have any questions, comments for the upcoming guest, something that you want me and Owen to talk about on the air, feel free to shoot us a line at info@MoreliaPythonRadio.com. And we'll do our best to make sure that we get your question answered. And then for me, it's just ebmorelia.com, and that's all I got. Go ahead, Owen.
What I got is we have the Oaks Reptile Show coming up November 9th, as well as I think we're going up to York the following weekend. We're going to try out a new show, York, PA, so we'll see how that's going to roll. Those are the two upcoming shows. You can also contact us via website at rogue-reptiles.com, as well as Facebook at Rogue Reptiles on Facebook. And I wanted to get your opinion on this thing, Eric. Herp Pro, you use that, correct?
What is it? Herp Pro?
Herp Pro, yeah.
Herp Pro. What is that? No, I don't use it.
You had those damn barcodes in your cages.
No, I use Reptile Scan.
Reptile Scan. All right. Well, Herp Pro is this program that I'm getting signed up for, which the same thing, you can have the barcodes on the cages, as well as you can set up a whole database, lineage information, all this stuff. It looks fantastic. So keep a watch on Rogue's Facebook page. We're going to be giving reports on how we're going to do that, and as well as if it's something that I think other people should look into. It looks fantastic. You can set up a ton of things, and you can go back and type in the certain genetics. You can have all this family trees. It looks fantastic, and it keeps me doing the lineage, but it looks easy, so I don't have to do too much work, which is great. So,
work smarter,
I'll
not harder,
you know.
Right?
I know. So that's pretty much all I got, so we'll let you know how that goes. That's all I got for right now, and that's all we got for this week. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll catch you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.